Hello, and welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts, part of the Heroes Podcast Network, or your bi-weekly Star Trek podcast, where we discuss things like Star Trek games, movies, books, comics. I'm one of your regular hosts, Greg Bosco, and with me, as always, is Mr. Derek. Say hello, my friend.
Hello, hello, and happy Star Wars Day to you, Greg.
Yes, for those who, other fellow sci-fi fans out there, we are recording this on May the 4th. Which is the wonderful Star Wars, May the 4th be with you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always laugh at that because tomorrow people are like, oh, it's Revenge of the 5th because of Revenge of the 6th. And I'm like, no, you guys are cutting out a day. It's the 5th strikes back, and then it's Revenge of the 6th. You see? Right. So we can have three Star Wars. Every day is Star Wars Day, right? Or Star Trek Day.
Celebrate your fandoms whenever you want. That's really what it comes down to. But,
except for Game of Thrones now. Nobody talks about it.
There is that meme going around of like just like the four black cells that are like, man, the battle at the end of season 8 was great, you know?
Oh my God. And everybody, you know, there's always people defending it. You just got to turn your TV up. I'm like, wait a second. I remember posting a meme the Battle of Helm's Deep. I'm like, Helm's Deep was in the night. And there was not a single time where people were watching Helm's Deep going, what the hell's happening here?
I don't think I should have to adjust my TV for one specific show. Just personally.
I would agree with that.
You know, I mean, I guess we do it for video games, right? You start the video game up and it's like, change your brightness until you can barely see this logo or whatever.
I mean, maybe for like a horror game, but if you're playing like Civilization VI.
That's anyways, fair. I've been playing a lot of horror games.
Well, this isn't our Game of Thrones podcast yet. No. There's a million and a half Game of Thrones podcasts out there. We don't need to have another one.
Yeah, well, there's hardly any Star Trek podcasts, so that's why we thought this would be good.
I mean, there's a lot of Star Trek podcasts, but the thing is, they each have their own flavor.
That's true.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
But anyways, we're back. You know, the last episode we recorded got some good feedback from friends and listeners that we know about talking about starships. Specifically for the Federation style or the Federation ships. We got through about half of the stories. This week we are going to kind of focus more on like Enterprise, Picard, and Discovery, the shows that we really didn't get to touch on. As Derek and I were talking before we started recording, there's the new promo out there for Discovery Season 3. Not a lot of new images, but it's out there.
You can watch it, yeah.
I mean, you can watch it.
It's funny. This is actually like the way we kind of split things up, and this was not on purpose. It was like last episode was everything produced in the 20th century, and then this episode is all 21st century Star Trek.
That's a good point.
You know, that was convenient.
The one thing I was laughing at, though, about the Discovery promo is Burnham's hair is super freakishly long right now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So apparently, you know, hair doesn't grow that fast, you know, a half inch a month. So they've been stuck in the future for 4 years already.
I think she has. I don't think they end up coming out at the same spot, you know. I think that she's been marooned by herself for quite some time, and they're going to have to find each other, you know.
Maybe it's that one alternate future that, you know, in the episode Parallels, where there's like a million different Worfs jumping through the timelines, and it's the one where the Federation's gone, and Riker's got the crazy beard. You're almost to that Riker beard level right now.
Yeah, it's bad, man. It's definitely long. I haven't really had a good reason to shave it in a while. I was growing it out over the winter for a cosplay. I was doing a Vault Dweller from Fallout group with some friends for a convention that ended up being postponed. And I let it grow from I shaved on Halloween for a costume. And then so from November 1st, and I didn't shave again until like February. And that was pretty good, but this isn't that bad. But
see,
anyway.
this is not shaving for 37 years because Derek and I are on Zoom right now. But my regular hair grows like not like crazy. So
yeah,
go figure.
Yeah, versus I shave my head now, you know, for aesthetic reasons, of course.
Aesthetically, you know, it's almost the Picard. You're the Picard Riker clone.
So anyway, okay, so before we dive into the starships, I did want to talk about a poll that we did on our Facebook group. So we have a Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/redshirtsandrunabouts. And I like doing polls. And I did this one where I asked what people's favorite Enterprise bridge is, specifically Enterprise versions. And, you know, there was a bunch of options and you could add your own, of course, because there's a lot you could add. And what I thought was interesting, more than what won, I found it the most interesting that the original TOS TV show version didn't get any votes.
I was kind of surprised by that, given the fact that on our fan base on the Red Shirts and Runabouts forum, we've got generations of fans. Mm-hmm. People that were born in the late 50s became fans in the 60s. So that's the Star Trek they grew up with. And a lot of them were selecting, you know, the Enterprise D.
And that's what won. Now, to be fair, we put any variation of the Enterprise D bridge. And I did that just because I didn't want to end up in a semantic argument, because it changes a couple of times in the show. Then, of course, you have different, you know, alternate futures, right? Like Riker's version in the All Good Things alternate future. And then you have the Generations bridge is different than the TV show bridge, because they rebuilt it for the movie. And then, you know, there were some changes in between seasons. And so, like, I didn't want to get into that. But the D bridge won. That was our number one choice. Number two was the Enterprise E, which that makes sense. And then the third choice was my favorite, which is actually the Discovery Enterprise bridge, which we get to see a little bit, not as much as I would have liked, but I found that to be just so strikingly fantastic that when I saw that bridge and I saw how detailed it was and how good it looked and how full it was, I immediately had that thought of, there's no way we're not going to keep seeing this in some show, right? Like, there's going to be this Enterprise is going to be a thing. And that's what I voted for. What did you vote for?
Mine was the Constitution Refit Bridge.
Oh, okay.
Just something about it I loved. I loved how it was that weird mixture of early 80s tech trying to pretend what the future is going to look like. So they still have like push buttons, but then they still have tactile buttons that don't need like a physical action. You just tap them. Mm-hmm. And so it was always fun. And I love it because that, and it basically every one of those movies, that bridge just gets jacked up, whether it's number one or number two or number three, obviously. And then five, it's like a disaster. And then six, every single movie, something horrible happens to that bridge. It's what can I say?
Well, as one of our listeners pointed out in the group, Eric, I'm just going to give a shout out to him for this, because I always forget that this is the case. But if at the end of a voyage home, when they first get on the Enterprise A, and they're on it very briefly at the tail end of the film, and it's gorgeous, right? That's actually it changes by the time you get to the fifth movie and you have an actual full film on the ship. That bridge is different. And so that was his vote, was the voyage home version of the Enterprise A bridge. So we're getting into the nitty gritty.
once we start going to, it's like the future imperfect version, that one episode of the Next Generation Enterprise D bridge. It's like, all right, there's a million and one combos we could do.
But they, I mean, most of them got votes. I mean, there were votes for the B and the C, the NX-01, even the Kelvin got some love. So, you know, lots of variety out there from people.
I have to admit, there's little redeeming value of the Kelvin Universe Enterprise bridge to me. It's the joke is it looks like an iPod.
It's the Apple Store. Yeah.
It's the Apple Store.
Space.
It's like you're scared to touch it. It's like when you go to a relative's house, you can tell if it's a home or a house. Because a home will have like stuff disheveled because they don't care. They got three kids. They're fine. But a house is like everything is perfect, right?
Yep.
It's like you're scared to sit on anything. That's that is the Kelvin Universe Enterprise.
That's funny.
But we're here to talk about starships.
Yes, starships.
And
so
I'm gonna have to rely on you a lot more for Enterprise, because I know it's 2020 and I still haven't seen it all the way through.
So, I mean, we'll get the big fish out of the way, right? And that's, of course, the NX-01. It's actually the NX class, which is kind of a fun thing to talk about, because we had already had NXs prior to this. We obviously not chronologically, but production-wise, because the Excelsior was an NX, and the first Defiant is an NX, not the second Defiant.
Paulo or something. Yeah.
So we've had NXs before, and they were always kind of framed as like prototype vessels. And this is also a prototype vessel, of course, because it's the first Warp 5 ship that Earth has managed to produce, that Starfleet has produced. But it being the NX class is it's an interesting conversation that I probably need to look more into about whether what that really means, right? Was this the first ship to bear that class? You know, that's what it seems like. Now we do get to see, a lot of this ship. This ship gets shown really, really well in incredible detail because it's a lot smaller than the other Enterprises, right? This ship is not even that much bigger than the Defiant. The crew of the NX-01 Enterprise is basically the maximum capacity of the Defiant, which is pretty impressive. The show Enterprise, of course, tried to distance itself a bit from Star Trek in the first season, not just in name of the show being called just Enterprise. There's lots of differences, right? They can polarize the hull plating, for example, and they have a grappling hook, which in Star Trek Online is one of the coolest little devices. Did you ever use it?
I didn't get enough into Star Trek Online, and I really need to go back.
Oh man. So you could get the NX and it has a grappling hook. And what you could do, what I would do is I would basically go to ram a ship. And a lot of the encounters back when I first started were like Klingon encounters, right? So you're you've got a collision course set and you'd be firing full front because that's what the NX has, is just mainly front weapons. And then you would pass the ship, right? You'd go over it and I'd fire the grapple behind me to hook onto the Klingon ship and then swoop nice. Back around. It was cool.
Yeah. I'm looking at the wiki of the NX class. There it is, the polarized hull plating, mm-hmm. which that we were just joking about it in the Kelvin universe on the USS Kelvin, when they first encounter the Romulan time Borg ship, the one captain says polarized view screen. So there we go. There's a nice little, that's the thing about Abrams is he knows how to throw those little things in there.
That's for sure. I always loved this design. I thought that they actually did a really damn good job with it. And it is a shame that we never got to see the refit of it that was planned. There was a planned refit that included a secondary hull. And I urge you right now to Google what that looks like, because I think it's fantastic. I think it was a beautiful, proto Enterprise design. And the style of the ship I always thought was really gorgeous. And as I mentioned last episode, Greg, it's kind of like an upside down version of your favorite ship.
It is, absolutely. And there's even an image on the wiki of the two of the Columbia and the Enterprise doing special maneuvers where the Columbia is upside down. And yeah, it's the Akira. It is absolutely right? Where they got that design from the Akira class, which is cool.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on the NX class? I've been talking a lot. I apologize.
Well, I like it because the thing I enjoy about it the most is when you're making a prequel show using modern technology, which is what Star Trek Enterprise was, mm-hmm. It would have been very easy for the designers to go overboard and make a ship that still looks like a Starfleet ship, but almost make it seem too advanced for what it's supposed to be. This, the design they did, still looks like it's Starfleet still getting used to having, Warp 5. Mm-hmm. That's one of their limits, is building a fleet of Warp 5 ships. And it's kind of focused on things like maneuverability, and such, versus the Enterprise D, which is obviously not a highly maneuverable ship compared to the Defiant,
right
with that gigantic saucer section. But it's good because I think it stuck very close to what Star Trek was aiming for with things like the phase cannons. I've always loved phaser cannons or plasma cannons. Mm-hmm. It's a little Star Warsy, but at the same time it makes sense for technology. A single focused beam is not easy, but pulsing it's fun, and I like it, and I like that it follows the mythos that we know of Star Trek, whereas as Starfleet expanded, there was, the first NX classes, and then you had the big Constitution classes. So they kept building ships in phases, which has always been kind of neat to me, because mm-hmm. we kind of lost that, if you think about it, in Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. But old school, and we talked about this last week, the naval tradition, they would build clusters of ships of the exact same design. And that's kind of what the NX was Starfleet's first true I mean, you had the Daedalus class beforehand and the Romulan War, or around this time as well, which I think you even see an image of the Daedalus class, right? In Enterprise? It's the one ship with the gigantic salt, like the gigantic ball saucer.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if you get to actually see one.
Maybe it was in the cut season 5 stuff they were doing, because they were going to start getting involved in the Romulan War.
I wanted to talk about that ship design, because it's kind of almost reused in All Good Things for the Pasteur.
Which it really is.
Which we didn't discuss last time. I always love that design because, you know, there's a sense that a lot of Star Trek's ships are very aerodynamic looking. Maybe not the original Enterprise, but the Enterprise E and the Defiant and Voyager, which of course can land, so that makes sense. But a lot of those ships don't really need to be aerodynamic. And so having something like the Daedalus class or the Pastor, I always thought was a really cool sci-fi-y concept.
And I think that's what I like about the NX so much, is it's simple but elegant, which is kind of hard, which is hard to pull off. You know, you can go overboard with ship designs. Like, even one of the complaints of Star Wars is some of the ship designs, you're like, holy crap. You're like, why would you design something in this manner? And the Nebulon B frigate, I love that ship. It's a great ship. But at the same time, you're like, who builds a ship with a gigantic front end, a gigantic back end, and a tiny midsection?
Right.
You're like, who would design that? Why? And the NX looks like a natural construction that would lead to what we end up seeing with the Constitution clash and such. Mm-hmm. Now, you've talked about this before. We have a lot of dead space between the timeline of Enterprise and the Romulan War and the Discovery timeline, which is before the original series. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have 70 years of starship design where we have no idea.
Oh yeah.
What they're really doing. We have fan art, but we don't really have anything above and beyond that.
My favorite works that kind of help bridge that gap are from a fan production called Pacific 201. And you can look that up. And the USS Pacific, I think it's like NCC. I think it's 20. Yeah. NCC 201. I love their design work. I think it's gorgeous. And I think it's a really beautiful bridge between the two. Cause you can start seeing how the designs look very TOS-y from like a hull plating standpoint, but they're still not quite as sophisticated or quite as large. And they still have a lot of components that look like the NX. And so I like that a lot, but it is an empty space, right? There's not a lot there. We have a lot of these gaps because we also have that gap between the Undiscovered Country and the beginning of TNG, because all we've really seen in between there is the Enterprise B and the Enterprise C.
That's yep. Really... And we only see the Enterprise C for like 30 minutes.
Right? That's all we really ever get to see. And I would have liked to know more about that time frame and why the ship design went in the direction that it did. Now, in Enterprise, we don't get to see much else. There's a lot of very tiny vessels that are protecting Earth that we get to see very, very little limited. We, of course, do get to see three ships in the intro to the show in addition to the NX, which includes the Phoenix from First Contact, which, again, we didn't really discuss. It's not really – I don't know if you – it's a star. It's a spaceship. I don't know if it's a starship. I don't know.
I mean, it does have warp capability, but maybe warp capability to go to the moon and back.
Right. There's two other ships in there. It's the OV-165 and the SS Emmett. And the OV-165 is a design that I truly love because it's incredibly realistic. It's actually something that NASA has worked on the concept of and the design of. And it's believed that that's really the next evolution of the shuttle, the NASA shuttle. It's, you know, wider. It's kind of a more sleek design than the shuttle. It's designed and intended to really only exist in space, to be built in space and go between, you know, stations, that kind of thing. Not a warp capable vessel either, so maybe not a starship, but I always loved that that was thrown in there because, you know, Enterprise came out back in 01 and it goes through the time periods and you get to see the International Space Station get completed, which it wasn't finished at the time, right? And then they jump ahead to the OV-165 and I was like, oh man, when do we get that? Because the next jump is the Phoenix and then it's warp capable and that's, you know, that's where the sci-fi really comes in. So
yeah. No, it's, and that's the thing is, they did a good job with not going overboard with making designs that look realistic to the technology. Like you said, the OV-165 is definitely a modern space shuttle. Hopefully we come back to having space shuttles again. Although side topic, I don't know if everybody out there is familiar. If you're listening to us, you probably like sci-fi and starships and Star Trek and such. We're sending astronauts into space using American-made spaceship on May 24th. One of the really? SpaceX capsules. It's the first since I think they said it's the first time since 2011 using an American designed and built ship launched from America to go back into space.
It's exciting. I was very sad when they decommissioned the shuttles. I mean, don't get me wrong. I know that we need something new, but my hope had always been we would have that something new to replace those relatively quickly. And that never happens.
Maybe if NASA just calls them like jet fighter planes, they'll get the funding instead of calling them space shuttles.
Right.
Just convince them, oh yeah, this can drop bombs. Here's $100 billion. Build that. Anyways, we're not here to talk about that. We're talking Star Trek. We're talking Enterprise. But you're right. There's not a lot of ships in Enterprise. Even non-Federation ships, we don't get a whole lot of variety. But again, it's like what you've been mentioning for the years we've been doing Red Shirts. It's a shame that they cut Enterprise when it was just starting to build up. Mm-hmm. So who knows what they could have done if they had the full 7 seasons.
Now, the other ship that we get to see very briefly is, of course, the Enterprise J, which is a Universe-class starship, which I get it, right? It's supposed to be the bigger, badder Galaxy class. I understand, but I always thought that was a little cheesy. It's massive. That ship is absolutely huge. If you look up like the scale of that thing compared to anything else, it is like we talk about how the Enterprise D is like a cruise ship in space. The Enterprise J is like a freaking city, right? It's like New York City flying through space, you know?
Yeah, it is it's a goofy, flat, gigantic design that, yeah, it's just, I don't know, I never really cared for it. They're trying to make it futuristic, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you have to realize that, you know, the Enterprise C, D, and E were all built within like 40 years of each other. So at the rate they're losing Enterprises, the J could be 20 years after the E. I mean, we know it's not.
They were getting optimistic.
They were definitely getting optimistic, hey, yeah.
So, okay, real quick. This is somewhat tangential, but I noticed something that I hadn't really thought of before. So the Enterprise, right, has all these letters because they keep making more. But that's happened to other ships many, many, many times. And it actually happens on Deep Space Nine, but the Defiant never gets an A.
Never gets an appendix number or digit, nope.
So I'm wondering if there's a canon reason for that, if there's an actual in-universe reason for why the Enterprise is treated special.
I have no idea myself.
Right? Because, like, the Defiant, yeah, it's basically the same ship that's replaced. But the argument could be made that the refit Enterprise and the Enterprise A are both Constitution classes. They're not all that different either. So, I don't know. It just seems odd to me that no other ship seems to get the letter.
Well, it's odd, and it's also, and that's something I've been talking about, is so much of Star Trek is based on like real naval history, naval lore, when it comes to starships, is we've had a bunch of Enterprises in real life, and we don't throw like another digit or number on our letter on there. It's just, hell, I think we're building a new aircraft carrier now they're going to call the Enterprise, because we just decommissioned the old Enterprise that was built in the 60s, like a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. It's not the Enterprise-E. I think they did it for the movies, because they had a bigger budget. Let's have some fun. And then it just became this thing over and over and over again.
Like, it would make sense to me if you were going to keep more than one in service at the same time, because you would need to differentiate them, right? But there's only ever one Enterprise in service, so the registry number is still only used one time.
And it would be really weird if they had two Enterprises flying around at the exact same time.
I mean, I agree with you, but you know. Maybe they're like, well, guys, look, this is the future, so there's time travel, and we have to be able to talk about multiple versions of the same ship. So
there's an alternate timeline out there where the Enterprise-Z wasn't sent back in time.
Exactly.
And they helped the Federation win the war with the Klingons. And so now there's two Enterprises. The Enterprise-C and the Enterprise-D.
Exactly. Okay, so that kind of wraps up Enterprise. We're going to take a short break before we come back to talk about New World Trek, so Star Trek Discovery and Star Trek Picard. So we will be right back after these messages.
Recently on the Heroes Podcast Network, Echo Station.
Well, what's the main planet that Endor, the forest moon of Endor? It's a moon. So there's a major planet, obviously, that it...
Is the forest moon of Endor? Is Endor the actual planet then?
See, isn't that confusing? Yes. Is it the forest moon of the planet Endor, or is it the forest moon called Endor?
Kaiju Curry House.
Because I'm just wondering, are Pokemon Kaiju?
They are pocket monsters. They are pocket monsters, Paul.
They're monsters,
yeah,
aren't they?
They are yokai, officially.
Yokai?
Yeah, so...
What's a yokai?
Screen Heroes.
If the MCU gets that, then I really think... that Space Jam needs to be part of the DCEU.
Yes!
Okay, because...
they have a big Marvel versus DC crossover where Air Bud takes on Space Jam. Man, we should write for these companies.
That's what it comes, it's Air Bud versus Bugs Bunny. That's what it's right. All come down to.
One-on-one.
Yes, done. All right. And then, like, at the end, it's Galactus versus LeBron James.
And Squirrel Girl wins.
Subscribe today at heroespodcast.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, Podcast Addict, and more.
All right, so we are back. We've been talking starship design. Now on to the show, Star Trek Discovery. Of course, there is the Discovery, but before we get there, we have lots of ships that we got to see at the Battle of the Binary Stars, and that all starts on the USS Shenzhou, which is a Walker-class starship, and absolutely one of my favorite starship designs I've ever seen. Greg, what do you think?
Yes. No, it was, and I think that even surprised the showrunners, because the reaction to the Shenzhou and Giorgio and everything was so huge that even they admitted they didn't anticipate that much level of interest. And, you know, especially when you compare it to the Discovery is like a neat design, but it almost looks like a gigantic pizza cutter in space. Whereas the Shenzhou is, it's elegant, but it's not over the top. It looks Starfleet through and through, whereas Discovery kind of doesn't.
I think that's the key. You look at the Shenzhou and it looks like a Starfleet vessel, right? It's got a lot of the components we're used to seeing, the colorings, the markings. It's all very, very familiar. And it's different though at the same time. It's funny because it's similar to the NX class, it's similar to the Akira class, right, in its structure. You've got your saucer section, you've got your two nacelles down below. There's a bit of a secondary hull on the Shenzhou though, which is pretty cool. And it just looks like it belongs, you know. It never crosses your mind that it's not a Star Trek vessel. It just seems badass. You get to see it kind of enter the atmosphere at one point, and you get to see the interior of it. And Giorgio, I'm sure, plays a part in that because she was so wonderful and had such an incredible presence as a captain that you buy into the whole thing pretty quickly.
Yes, you do.
Right. But I mean, I love that design. I think it was super cool, and it's a shame that we get to see so little of it throughout the show.
Well, and even your point about the Battle of the Binary Stars, we saw a bunch of neat looking ships there that we either never get to see again or are never even referred to again. I mean, yeah, the Shenzhou is there, but you have the Europa, which is like the flagship, which is definitely a very neat looking design. And you had other ships that were distinct and different from the Shenzhou and the Discovery, but we don't really get to, you know, they don't have their Excelsior yet like they do in Star Trek Next Generation. Like the Excelsior class that always shows up. They don't have that yet. I don't know what the hell they're going to do now. You know, the only ships we really see in season two, aside from the Enterprise, is a shit ton of Section 31 ships and some Klingon ships.
I think the big problem with the Discovery itself is we get to see all these other ships first, and they all look like they belong, right? You see all of these other Starfleet vessels, and they all look like Starfleet vessels. What we're used to seeing, what we are familiar with, what we associate with Starfleet. And then the Discovery comes in, and yes, it's based on the McQuarrie design, and that's a clever way to kind of harken back to Star Trek that never was. And I appreciate that level of detail and homework. But it's a weird ship. It's designed strangely. It's incredibly long and stretched out. The whole, it's like, it's strange because it looks more CGI-y than other ships because of the way it's so kind of metallic and reflective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because that's where it starts getting to the point where it looks like it doesn't belong. And yeah, you build experimental starships. The Voyager and the Intrepid class were somewhat experimental, but they sure as hell look like they belong.
The Defiant was experimental. The Excelsior was experimental. The NX class was experimental. You know, we have no shortage of experimental vessels in Star Trek. You know, and I understand like the spinning of the saucer had to do with the spore drive, and that's fine. That doesn't really bother me. It's kind of like Voyagers and the cells that fold up, whatever. But the nacelles on the Discovery are so elongated, and the ship just looks so flat in design compared to everything else. It just never really seemed to feel right to me.
Yeah, it just, and that's the thing that it's hard to describe, is I know there's going to be a couple of our loyal listeners out there going, well, you know, the Defiant doesn't look like a traditional starship. So why does that get a pass? You're right, it doesn't, but they specifically mention, like the first moment you see it on screen, when Sisko basically said, he's like, this was a new class of ships designed for Starfleet. We were going to build our new, it was going to be the flagship of our new battle fleet.
And I mean, I don't know that I agree with the premise that the Defiant doesn't look like the rest. It doesn't have nacelles that stand out on its own. But other than that, it does kind of match a lot of Starfleet design. The color schemes, the bulkheads, the hull plating, it's all very Starfleet. It's basically like a Reliant without nacelles.
I mean, I was almost going to compare it to the Nova. If you put a couple nacelles on it, very similar to the Nova class with the angular design and such. It's just, yeah, I mean, the Crossfield class of ship, and if I'm trying to remember right, I think Crossfield was, he was a real person. I think he was a pilot in history that was competing with Jaeger to see who's going to be the first one to break the sound barrier. And it's like Jaeger would break it, then Crossfield would break it, back and forth. So, I mean, that's a neat throwback to the historical name of a class of ship. But again, it's, and we see two, or we know of two of the Crossfield classes, right? You have the Discovery. God, what was the other one? It's going to kill me. The Glenn.
Yeah. And I think there were only two. It was really alluded to the idea that there were only two people that could operate these ships, right? Stamets and the other guy who died. And that was it. And so I don't think they made any more of them.
I don't think so. And with what happened to the Glenn, which did not go well. So no,
not quite.
one of the few Star Trek horror episodes is about the Glenn. And again, it's compared to the other ships we saw at the Battle of the Binary Stars, the Discovery, the Crossfield is a drastically different design. By far. I mean, there's very few similarities. And like you said, a lot of it's probably driven by the spore drive. But, you know, it also has nacelles. So it's not just about the spore drive. And again, Discovery's a little different, and we don't get to talk about a lot of the nitty gritty stuff about the ships like we do with the other series. You know, Voyager loves having episodes talking about those gel packs.
Right.
And DS9, they're always talking about fixing the shields or fixing the Cardassian sabotage or something. The Enterprise, they comment, or the Enterprise D, excuse me, they comment over and over again how big it is, how many people it can carry. Discovery, we don't really get a lot of on-screen chatter about ships aside from the spore drive.
No, you're right. There isn't a lot of talk about that. We don't get to see much of it, much of the other ships that Starfleet even has out at the time. Like we know that the Constitution class is out there, you know, but we don't really get to see it until the end of, you know, the very tail end of season one. And even then they might be a little bit different because when we see a blueprint of the Defiant appears different than the Enterprise does. Before we get to the Constitution classes, though, I don't want to overlook a mirror universe ship, which is the Emperor's ship, Emperor Georgiou's ship, the ISS Charon. Mm-hmm. That thing is just intense. It kind of reminds me of the time ship from the Year of Hell on Voyager.
Ooh, yeah, I see what you mean.
A little bit. It's obviously very different, but it just reminds me of that kind of concept. You know, it's massive, incredibly powerful. And it's just a very different kind of design, which, you know, it's the mirror universe, right? So things are going to be a little different. You know, the Shenzhou still exists there. So the Walker class was still made. And we know that the Constitution class is still there, of course. But this thing is like, I mean, it's basically like Star Trek Star Destroyer, you know?
It really is, and it's harnessing the power of like a star.
Right. Yes. Which is like, I mean, that's pretty amazing in itself because you have the episode of TNG Relics with Scotty and the whole the Dyson sphere concept, right? And this obviously is not a Dyson sphere, but it's still very impressive to be able to harness that kind of power on a single vessel. And so I just like to bring that one up because it's so drastically different from everything else we see from Starfleet as far as ship design is concerned.
I mean, yeah, and even drastically different. It's, you know, we can still touch, we haven't seen any, you know, Romulan ships, but we saw some Klingon ships. Mm-hmm. Again, it's some of them I thought were pretty weird designs. But obviously you have the D7, which is the traditional Star Trek Klingon design, which was amazing to see on screen.
Well, don't go in too much detail because we're going to do alien ships at some point.
And I won't go in too much detail, but what I will say is, since we are focusing on Federation ships, is the D7 design does not match any of the other Klingon designs either.
No.
So maybe I'll give the Crossfield class a little credit where credit's due. But again, and like we were talking about, we don't know what's going to happen in season 3, if they abandon the Discovery, if they keep it. I'm assuming a 22nd century starship, 23rd century starship, and wherever the hell they are, 33rd century, is that it?
The 31st century.
31st century.
It's, okay, I mean, this is spoiler territory for season 2 of Discovery, of course, at this point. But, I mean, there's the Short Treks episode. I'm drawing a blank on the name of it right now. But the ship has to get lost in the future with no crew at some point.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just kind of waiting for that to happen. You know?
Yeah.
And look, hey, maybe it'll be great. I'm actually really glad they're in the future because it gives them an opportunity to do whatever the hell they want without us, you know, complaining about canon. And I know canon can be a touchy subject. I know some people live in canon, some people despise canon. You know, I'm in the camp that canon is important to just be able to have a conversation about what actually happened in that fictional universe. You know,
I agree with you completely.
Right. It's the historical account of that universe. And to some extent, to some respect, what Disney did with Star Wars is kind of cool because you have the legends, which is basically like Star Wars mythology. You know, I like that idea. The idea that this story is like our Greek myths, but for Star Wars, right? For that universe. And Star Trek doesn't really have that. An argument could be made that all the novels, you know, they're beta canon. So maybe that's legends for Star Trek. I don't know.
I know what you mean. But yeah. And that's the thing is, you and I could have, again, we could have dozens of episodes on canon, but there's a certain level of importance because it binds the story together. Because mm-hmm. people, by nature, I mean, Joseph Campbell wrote a whole bunch of books on the hero's journey, is the items that build into canon are important to have the stories make sense. It's, you know, it's like even on Deep Space Nine and the, I don't know, whatever it was, the first Battle of Chintaka, I think it was, when the Federation won with their alliance, but then like the Brains show up and they've got technology. The ships are much better than ours, but they got a certain technology to knock out like the shields and energy of Federation ships. And that turns into like an episode or two later, they're like, yeah, this really impacts Federation and Romulan ships, but not Klingons. And there's a scene where they're like, yeah, the Klingons are deploying their fleets to protect their other allies, but they're stretched thin. So it's like that one little piece of canon about the Brain having a capability impacts the war more than just one battle. Mm-hmm. And that's the fun of canon. It's, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the Discovery. We don't know what the genesis of the design was because they don't spend a lot of time on it. But yeah, it's even, again, everybody has to admit the Discovery show, I've talked about this during our reviews, they spare no expense when it comes to design and looks though.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I am with you there. So of course, kind of, you know, the elephant in the room as it pertains to Star Trek ships and Discovery, is the Enterprise, when the Enterprise shows up. Aside from that moment at the end of season one, just being really fantastic for me personally, I want to know, Greg, what do you think of the Discovery version of the Enterprise?
I love it. I love every piece of it to the point where it's not my... It's damn close to my favorite design for the Enterprise, because the Constitution refit is my absolute, absolute favorite. When we first see it in motion picture. And you know, my opinions on the Enterprise D. I love it, but the saucer section is just gigantic. And they did such a good job to pay homage without going over the board crazy. They didn't add, like, it's got 18 dual torpedo turrets on it and all this stuff that, you know, that there was some writer in the room going, hey, you know what we should do? We should give it cutting beams and... You know, there was. There had to have been somebody there saying that.
Oh, yeah.
And how whoever was pushing back was like, no, we don't want to stray too far. Let's use what we would have built in the 1980s. If we had the technology, let's do that now. And I think they did a good job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm with you 100%. I absolutely love the redesign of this Enterprise. I was super nervous when I realized we were going to see it. Because I didn't think we were going to see the Enterprise. I really didn't. And then, you know, at that moment where they're where the registry number is coming in, I was like, oh my God, it's going to be the Enterprise. And it comes out of the clouds, right? It's just, it's gorgeous. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. I love everything about it, like you said. There's some just minor changes to it that just make it look so... so much more realistic and less of like a toy. And look, I totally understand the original Enterprise was built out of plastic and cardboard and styrofoam in 1964 originally. I understand, and I don't mean any disrespect, but this is taking it to this next level of realism. And yeah, even just the minor changes of the nacelles being offset a little bit, or the windows in the top part of the saucer section, just give it these little flares of detail that are wonderful. And then, you know, you go inside and it never occurred to me that they were going to really be able to pull off this in a way that was special. And that's the only word that I have for it. It's special. What that bridge looks like, the way it looks exactly like the original, only absolutely incredible.
And I think the overall fan reaction echoes what you and I are saying is, you know, whatever people want to say, whatever their opinion is on Star Trek Discovery, I think a general consensus is it somewhat underperforms a little compared to what they were hoping. It's not a negative, you know, Star Trek Next Generation seasons 1 and 2 underperformed. It takes episodes, it takes TV series if you hit their strides. But the moment most fans saw the refit or the Enterprise and Discovery with that crew and the chemistry they had with Pike and Number One and such, most fans fell in love with it when it was only on screen for a little bit.
It's a special thing. I mean, look, Trekkies and non-Trekkies know what the original Enterprise looks like, right? Anybody can draw it and everybody knows exactly what it is, you know? And being able to take something that's so beloved from a franchise where we are so critical. I mean, let's be honest.
And yeah, be just able, a little bit.
You know, right? And be able to put out something that is truly something special is really amazing. And look, yes, we talked about how important Canon was a minute ago, and there are some changes. You know, there are two turbo lifts on this bridge, for example. You know, but some of those things I let slide because of the way we have to film today. It's filmed in widescreen. It's filmed in HD. It's filmed, you know, in 4 or higher K versus a 4:3 ratio for over the air television in the 60s. Sets are larger. Sets are more expensive. Sets are more detailed. They have to be. I mean, hell, if you talk to the Okudas back when they were bringing up TNG to Blu-ray, there were screens that had gibberish on them that you now had to you could actually read when it was brought up to Blu-ray quality. So they had to create text to put on those screens so people like you and me wouldn't read it and be like, well, that's fucking gibberish.
Right? What is this, a recipe for biscuits?
They had to put real stuff. And so you can't put the cardboard bridge on CBS All Access and on a new thing and have people take it seriously if it's anything other than like what Deep Space Nine did with the Trouble of Tribbles, or what Trials and Tribulations, excuse me, or what Enterprise did with, you know, In a Mirror Darkly, right? Those are specials, right? Those are homages. Those are for fun. You can't do this that way. And especially seeing that we really get to see the ship in season 2, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they have the BS explanations for why there's no holographic technology on it and it's all outdated tech. And I thought that it was funny, right? What are you going to do?
It was a throwaway.
Right? What are you going to do? You got to make it look as close to the original as you can. And I respect that. I do. I respect the work that went into that. And if I'm just going to say that if we don't get to see a Pike, Anson Mount, Pike, Rebecca Romijn, Una, and Ethan Peck, Spock show, I think that's a real loss for everybody in the Star Trek community. Because I think the three of them have something special. And I think the designers who built the Enterprise, who built the bridge, who built the uniforms, they all have something special. And I want to see that.
And again, obviously, most people who listen to us know I'm a critic of Enterprise, or excuse me, of Discovery and Picard. You know, I've said before many times, you can love something and still criticize it. I think they took a chance with Discovery and they took a chance with Picard, and it did, for better or worse, it had mixed. It wouldn't be shameful if the next series they make is something safe. If you use a Captain Pike episode or show, you can make it 4 seasons. You don't have to make it this epic 7, 8, 10 season nonsense that they're trying to do with every show nowadays. You could make it small. You could make it short, a very specific story to connect to the Pike days to the Kirk days. But again, it's in the thing, my favorite part of, so everybody knows who's listened, the season 2 Discovery finale, I was not a fan of, with the space shuttle nonsense and fighters and just whatever. The thing I did like about the battle, and spoilers, is, and Derek, you and I have been talking about this, is during the original series and stories and books and such, the Constitution class was always highly regarded for its durability in combat. Mm-hmm. And you really get to see that in season 2, where it's taking on, you know, 8, 10 Section 31 ships, and it's being damaged, but it's holding its own.
Right.
And that's something that was always supposed to be the thing of the Constitution class, was tough, durable, reliable, and we really get to see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the few times that we get to see it. We get to see it in The Undiscovered Country, because it basically takes, like, I think it's 3 direct hits from a torpedo from a Klingon bird of prey. You know, but we don't get to see a lot of that otherwise. You know, Wrath of Khan, it's not really fair because it's another Federation vessel at point blank range that can shoot through the shields. Or the shields aren't even up, you know? Yep. And so that's not really a fair comparison. And so this was the first time you really get to see the Enterprise in a real battle scenario. Not one-on-one, you know? Because it's usually one-on-one, right? Like,
It's like you're watching the season two finale and you're like, man, if there was three Constitution classes there, not one, I'm like, man, they might win. Because the Enterprise was doing good.
Right? Where are the rest of those ships? No, I'm with you. And we've talked about the finale of Discovery. I think you and I pretty much agree on it. And the Enterprise was the shining moment.
Yeah, it really was.
You know.
Discovery's just sitting there. I mean, the Enterprise is flying around to try to protect it. I'm like, that was fun.
So before we wrap up, we have to talk about Picard. Is there anything else on Discovery that you want to discuss?
No, but I will say I think Discovery is doing a good job using modern technology to make starships. Just because I don't like the design of the Discovery of the Crossfield class doesn't mean I hate it.
Yeah.
I think the Oberth class is kind of goofy, but I don't hate it.
The Oberth class is silly as hell. And there are some other very silly kit bashings that occurred back in the model days, you know, on TNG and stuff like that, that are very, very silly. So by no means am I giving every ship that's ever existed a pass until you get to Discovery.
I mean, even seeing some of the drawings from the original series where they had, like, that we never see on screen, but they wanted to put on screen, like Starfleet tugs, where it's basically almost a Constitution class ship, but instead of a secondary hull, it's a gigantic, like 3-kilometer tube.
Yep.
With warp nacelles on there. And you're like, that just doesn't make sense for
dude. Even just the prototype version of Voyager, before Voyager became what it looked like, there was a very different design of Voyager that's pretty ridiculous looking. And clearly, at least in my opinion, they made the right decision, right? So there's been some strange designs. Sometimes they look better than others. The prototype of the Ambassador class, the Enterprise C, I actually like better than the version they ended up using. It's a more subtle difference, but you know, there's a lot that comes to design, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. it's cost. Sometimes it's artistic decisions, and so there's a lot of subjectivity in there. So, all right, so let's move on to Picard. We don't have a ton to talk about on Picard, as we really only see two Starfleet type vessels. First, we have the La Serana, which is the main ship that we are on throughout the show. That's Rios's ship. It's actually a Kaplan F-17 speed freighter for those playing at home. It's fine. I never really had strong feelings about it one way or the other. The fact that it's a freighter helps make a little more sense about the interior design of it, because it's basically just like a floating rectangle. You know, it's got like two decks and it's all empty space. There's not a whole lot else to it. And I found that I found myself kind of wanting more from that, you know, but it's fine. I don't know that I have any strong feelings either way.
Well, no, and I agree with you, is I don't really have strong feelings one way or the other. It serves its purpose. It's basically a transport ship in the show. Mm-hmm. It's not really made for combat, but it can fight. The La Serena, the name, it always actually gave me feelings from the Expanse books in the show, because one of the ships in that is called the Rocinante.
Ah.
Which is a very, very similar backing of a name. Which is, you know, whatever, that's fine. Star Trek's always borrowed ideas from other shows and history. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Plus, it fits with his background. As right. an actor and captain. So it was like, but again, it doesn't really stand out one way or the other. I don't think it's like the Enterprise B from Generations. It's like, yeah, it's there, but.
Well, even that one, I mean, I think stands out a little bit more because it's a modified Excelsior class. So that catches your attention a bit. It's a little sad because, and I feel like it's on purpose here, but the ship has always been a character in Star Trek, right? Whichever the show, doesn't matter. It's always been a character. And this is the first Star Trek show where I don't think that's the case. And I don't think that was the intention. I think the intention of the La Serana was just to get you there. Right?
We needed a lift. Yep. Needed a lift. This was available and this is who we were able to hire.
And, you know, from a story perspective, I think that's fine. I think we've just gotten comfortable with and gotten used to the idea of it being more significant. And I think that just catches people like me off guard.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, because the names of the major ships we've used have all been pretty iconic. They were almost iconic before Star Trek even existed. The Enterprise.
Right.
There's always been an Enterprise in U.S. naval history. You know, things like the Intrepid class starship, the Voyager. We had the Voyager space probes. Mm-hmm. The Defiant. The Defiant was one of our early frigates in naval history. So we've always relied on ship names that are very popular, very, very easy to learn, very easy to say. The Discovery, we had a space shuttle called the Discovery. The La Serena was the first one to really be truly unique and such on its own.
Yeah, that's fair. So that, of course, brings us to the final ship, which is the Zhang Ho, is how Riker pronounces it anyway. So I apologize if it should be something else. Riker's ship that he gets to have when he comes out of retirement. It is an Inquiry class vessel, is the official class type of the ship. We don't get a great look at the ship. There's a bunch of them. Now, some of the creators have said that there's multiple designs in here, and frankly, I have a hard time picking them out myself. But that's neither here nor there. This ship is a very safe design. It is incredibly similar to what you see in Star Trek Online, as far as like the Odyssey class, which is the Enterprise F, and some others like the Ezri's ship, Ezri Dax's ship in the books, the Avantine. It's all very similar. It's a very elongated saucer section that's merged with an elongated secondary hull with two beefy nacelles that are reminiscent of the Enterprise E, but stockier. And, you know, that's the ship. The bridge is a redress of the Discovery bridge, obviously for budgeting and simplicity purposes. And that's all we really get to know. Am I forgetting anything? Am I leaving anything out?
No, I mean, the meme, they call it the copy-paste class. because that's exactly what they did in the last battle. Like you said, people keep saying there's multiple designs in there. I'm like, maybe if I had a 120 frame per second capability and I could slow it down and inspect every single frame, maybe. But
I know that there's at least two, because I've been looking through images as I prepped for this, and there's a nice shot that they have online, and there are two. But you can't really see all of one of them, and so it's hard to see all the differences. But the nacelles are definitely different. And so that's something. But I don't know what that ship is. We don't get a name or a registry or anything, so I can't speak much to it.
Well, and of course, you know, we're not talking about Picard. But a little bit, you know, the Riker pulls the very famous bluff. I'm the captain of the most powerful ship in Starfleet. And the Romulan's like, oh, you're right. Because you know the Romulans have never heard of a bluff before, but whatever, it works. But it is interesting, and I know people have talked about the fact that the fleet, I don't even know how many ships were in the fleet.
I mean, there were 200 and like six or four or something Romulan ships, and there were more Federation ships. I forget the exact number, but
and I know people were defending, because that's something new for Star Trek, is building a lot of one single class of ships. At least in the Star Trek lore we know. Even in the Dominion War, you know, you think they would build nothing but like Akira class and Defiant class and Steamrunner class, but they're still building Galaxy class. They're still building all this other stuff. It's a little new for Starfleet. It's obviously, like you said, probably for budgetary purposes. They're not going to spend $2 million animating 30 different designs of starships for a five-minute scene.
Right.
If the show is not... Because the show is not necessarily about Starfleet as a whole.
Right.
It's more character-based, character-driven, which makes sense. And Deep Space Nine, you need lots of ships because they're at war. There's fighting on 20 different fronts at the same time. Mm-hmm. With Picard, you don't necessarily need that. So yeah, I'll nitpick and I'll poke at it. But even I can sit back and go, well, it's not about Starfleet. It's not about the ships.
Right. And it's not. And the truth is, part of the story is that the Federation hasn't done much. They've just been sitting back and building and building and building. And so if there's three or four designs in here and they just built 100 of each of them, You know, that was all maybe they felt they needed. Here's one warship, here's one science ship, here's one diplomatic vessel, and here's one medical ship or something. I don't know. Right? And that's all you need. And that's what they felt. I don't, you know, or maybe as starship design becomes more sophisticated, the need for different kinds of vessels diminishes because you can do it all on one ship. Right?
Yes, it's funny because the real U.S. Navy introduced a ship a couple of years ago called the Littoral Combat Ship, the LCS, and they were going to build like 60 of them, but they kept scaling it back because the first four they built were like terrible. Like, it was a good design on paper, but then when they actually put it out to sea, they're like, man, this ship can't handle, it can't fight, and we're stuck with it. And so they're building like 20 new frigates. They just signed a contract today based off an Italian design. And everybody's like, well, why'd you pick that? And they're like, we wanted to find a design that we knew worked.
Right.
And that's maybe exactly what they did in Picard, is they had a design that works for what they need. And they're not at war. Maybe they haven't been at war. Maybe the ships are a mix of everything. Like, good at combat, good at exploration, good at science, not great at anything.
Right.
Which would make sense if Starfleet's a little bit more inward. Mm-hmm. Build a few ships or less ships that are good versus a lot of ships that have very, very specific design, you know?
Exactly. Because it's true. Like, when you ended up with an Oberth class ship, what are they going to do? You know, it's a tiny vessel with 30 crew and hardly any weapon capabilities, you know? And, it's a good science vessel. Well, you know, it was a good science vessel. The Galaxy class was a good science vessel.
That was a great science vessel.
And it could kick your ass. So
it's like Voyager is a good example. Voyager was a great design. I love the ship. But you're not going to put the Intrepid class on the front lines against the Dominion.
Not on purpose.
Well, unless you absolutely have to.
Right.
And
so maybe they just started realizing that we'll just build them all the same, you know, or similar enough, you know.
Well, and then, you know, like, we could go down a different episode where it's like, well, 24th century, almost in the 25th century, you have matter, antimatter replicators. So material's not really a problem.
Yep.
So you could build as much of whatever as you want, technically. So yeah, they found a design that works, and they have 3D printers printing starships.
Really big ones.
Really big ones.
But I think that's it. I think that's it for the Starfleet vessels. We covered all of the canon stuff anyway. We didn't really talk much of the books or Star Trek Online. We referenced a couple of things here and there, but really just focused on what is canon, so to speak, Starfleet ship design. We definitely want to talk about more. We want to talk about the Klingons and the Romulans and the Andorians and, you name it. We want to focus on these other species as well and give them time. We didn't want to just rush over them all. So I'm sure we'll be doing that. Greg, is there anything else you want to add to our Starfleet starship design conversation?
Just that of all the sci-fi I know and love, and I love a lot of it, Babylon 5, Battlestar Galactica, Star Wars, Star Trek, et cetera, et cetera. Sequest DSV.
Hell yeah.
Star Trek. We'll do a special Sequest episode one day about Star Trek on this episode on Red Shirts and Runabouts. Star Trek, the ships. It's the only series where I became attached to ships. I think the Millennium Falcon, whatever. I know a lot of people love the Millennium Falcon. It's the Millennium Falcon. I got more attached like the X-Wing than I did the Millennium Falcon. But even in general, Star Trek ships I fell in love with. And that's something that I when I was 6 years old to now, I still love the ships of Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'm with you. I mean, I still have so many of my toys growing up, and most of them are ships. I mean, I had more ships than action figures when it came to Star Trek. And I have a good number of action figures. I love the ship designs, and I love the style, and I love the characters that they were on those shows. I hope that we get to see more. You know, I hope that, you know, with the animated stuff coming out, I hope they have some fun with the ship designs and do some quirky things that they can do in an animated world and have it still be okay. But we'll be back, of course, talking more and more about ships and Star Trek. Hoping for some news in the near future, you know, about when we might get to see season 3 of Discovery, because I definitely am curious to see what's going on in the 31st century. But I guess that's going to be it for us this week, Greg.
I think so, my friend. And if anybody wants to reach out to you directly and talk to you, how can they do that?
Well, I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter, of course. You can also find me on other shows here on the Heroes Podcast Network. I host Screen Heroes, and I've brought back, starting next week, Gamer Heroes, which is the video game podcast. It's alternating with Red Shirts right now. We're doing every other week, and so they're alternating with each other. So please check that out if you're into games. But that's me.
And if anybody's interested in reminding me how much I hate Star Trek, which is like the only messages I get sometimes, is the_bittersteel on Twitter. It's not everybody. It's like you get 10 good messages, then you get one hateful one.
Yeah.
That's the life of a podcaster.
It is. It definitely is.
I think most people like you get my sense of humor when it comes to, you gotta be able to poke what you love. I mean, come on.
Absolutely. But we love it. We wouldn't talk about it if we didn't love it. Right.
Yeah, you've been saying for as long as I've known you, if we didn't, the canon argument, if we didn't give a shit about Star Trek, we wouldn't care about canon.
Right. It wouldn't matter.
I mean, history. Napoleon wasn't 5'3". Napoleon was average height. That was British. It was British propaganda that said Napoleon was short. Facts matter, Derek.
Facts do matter. Facts matter. What's trust data, not lore. I love that sign.
Yeah, trust data, not lore.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are, of course, the Red Shirts and Runabouts podcast on the Heroes Podcast Network. You can find us at Red Shirts Pod on Twitter. You can join our Facebook group. Please join our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/Red Shirts and Runabouts. Our show is all over the podcast places. You can find us at heroespodcast.com and more. Please do that. Otherwise, Greg, I'll catch you in a couple of weeks.
I'll talk to you then, buddy.
May the 4th be with you.
Always.